Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is co-founder of Microsoft, entrepreneur and philanthropist Bill Gates, whose new book is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. He's joined in conversation by NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Bill Gates and Kristen Welker.
Good evening and welcome. My name's Holly Furfer. I'm a correspondent with CNN here in Atlanta. I'm pleased to welcome you to this very special book fest in your living room tonight, featuring technologist, business leader, philanthropist, and author Bill Gates. And he's being interviewed by Kristen Welker, co-anchor of Weekend Today and NBC News chief White House correspondent. And they will be discussing Mr. Gates' latest book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. And our author, Bill Gates, is a technologist, business leader, and philanthropist. In 1975, he co-founded Microsoft with his childhood friend, Paul Allen. And today, he and his wife, Melinda, are co-chairs of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He also launched Breakthrough Energy, an effort to commercialize clean energy and other climate-related technologies. He and Melinda have three children, and they live in the state of Washington. Okay, so before we bring on our guests, we want you to take a look at this short video, which will set the stage for what we are sure will be a fantastic conversation this evening.
In a typical year, the world emits over 51 billion tons of greenhouse gases. And as we keep doing that, the consequences for human life will be catastrophic. When I first fell in love with computers as a teenager, they were enormous, expensive, and only the government and big companies could afford them. But my friends and I became obsessed with a wild idea. What could we do if there was a computer on every desk? And now the wild idea is quite tame. Billions of people not only have computers on their desks, but even in their pockets. Now the world needs another breakthrough. In fact, it needs many breakthroughs. We need to get from 51 billion tons to zero while still meeting the planet's basic needs. That means we need to transform the way we do almost everything. Our commitment to developing these innovations will mean the difference between a future where everyone can live a healthy, productive life and one where we're constantly dealing with the human and financial crises at a historic scale. Entrepreneurs and investors have to build new businesses and change existing businesses to get these solutions deployed. Government leaders have to enact new policies that drive the market for clean energy. And advocates have to keep their voices loud to hold all of us accountable for rapid progress. Avoiding a climate disaster will be one of the greatest challenges humans have ever taken on, greater than landing on the moon, greater than eradicating smallpox, even greater than putting a computer on every desk. My basic optimism about climate change comes from my belief in innovation. It's our power to invent that makes me hopeful.
Good evening, everyone. Holly, thank you for that great introduction. And Bill Gates, welcome to you. It is so tremendous to have you here. I have your book here with the 1 million notes that I took while I was reading it, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. One of the things that is remarkable about this book is that you make a really difficult problem understandable and accessible. So we're going to go through all of that tonight. But I do want to start off, Bill, if I could, by asking you about something that is gripping the country right now, what is happening in Texas. You've been asked about this in various interviews. You've said that Texas could have been better prepared. And I want to ask you what we have learned from the crisis in Texas, and has it made you reevaluate
anything that you think about fighting climate change?
Yeah, it's a tragedy that with the cold weather there, they haven't been able to provide power. And that's led to a lot of suffering and even some deaths. One thing that's not responsible is that it's not the renewable energy that's the great deficit they're facing. There's, as you'd expect in cold temperatures, the wind is down somewhat. They didn't weatherize the wind as much as they do further north, where it can work in very, very cold temperatures. But it's mainly natural gas plants that weren't weatherized because they didn't create an incentive for that extra reliability the way they manage the bid market. There are two points that come out of this, though, that are relevant, even though it's not a failure of renewables. We will need to connect the country up with a lot more transmission to go from our current 6% renewables to a high number, like, you know, something like 80%. And, you know, we need to model out what that transmission looks like. Texas is a very special case. It's its own grid. There's a Western grid and an Eastern grid, and then there's Texas. We have three grids. And so Texas was unable, when it got into trouble on production capacity, to draw on any extra capacity in other states. It was completely on its own. And, you know, we're going to need a lot more transition, including big transmission into Texas itself. So there will eventually be the need to really study reliability when you have intermittent sources, and to have either a miracle of storage that you have the energy for these long bad weather periods, or you have something like nuclear, which is not weather dependent. You know, the current ways we make electricity, nuclear, coal and natural gas, are kind of indoor electricity generation. Only hydro of the significant sources is outdoor, but now with much more sun and wind, we have to model out the very worst cases so we don't let people freeze or overheat.
Well, and it's a reminder, I think, of the enormity, as you point out, of the crisis that you are tackling with this book. So let's talk about it and how you prepared yourself to write this book. You have taken on so many things, polio, malnutrition, the fight against COVID. How did you prepare yourself to write a book, to become an expert in climate change? And to some extent, this was a family affair, right?
Yeah, I've gotten to go out and see the amazing industrial economy, largely with my son, you know, paper plants, steel, cement, try and get a sense of all these things that are causing emissions and will have to change. The timeline is that as I, with my wife, put a commitment in the Gates Foundation after the year 2000, we were traveling in Africa quite a bit. And there were two things that I saw there. One is that there's very little electricity, which you need to develop those economies. And I saw that the farmers were having reduced productivity, you know, tougher weather that meant that the malnutrition problems were in many places getting even worse. And so I said, hey, I need to understand climate change because it'll affect how we get electricity to Africa. And I'm wondering, is the agriculture problems they're having, is that due to climate change? And so I was very lucky that six times a year I'd take a half day. A couple of great professors brought other experts in on a huge number of topics. Because climate change, you have to understand weather and economics and models and carbon capture, electricity, lots of things that we all kind of take for granted. And after about 5 years of that, I decided this is a huge problem. I started a company to keep nuclear fission alive with the new generation. I did a TED Talk. I have two sort of warning TED Talks. The 2010 one is the climate one. The 2015 was the one titled "We're Not Ready for the Next Epidemic," which sadly, although it's been watched a lot, it was supposed to be watched mostly before the pandemic, not after. So it didn't cause the preparedness I'd hoped for. And so, you know, even after 2010, after I gave that talk, I was tracking all the climate work, but still, as you say, mostly doing the global health things. In 2015, there was a chance to be part of the Paris event, which is it was called COP21, which is one of the big climate global meetings. And I went and we did an event on the side that I had suggested should be done, which focused on innovation. And we had 18 countries commit to double their R&D budgets, which is kind of the leading edge of driving innovation at high speed. I committed to those governments that I would create a venture group designed just for climate change, which is called Breakthrough Energy's Ventures. It's Breakthrough Energy, sort of the umbrella of all the things I'm doing. And then the venture group was the first big piece of that. And that's been very successful. It went into 40 companies. It's raised a second fund. But then the thing that really got me amazed was the growing commitment to climate as an issue by the younger generation. And so I saw that, you know, two of the three components were there, the belief that something should be done, the goal of getting to zero by 2050, but no plan that actually took into account all the different areas and all the different actors that would have to be orchestrated. And so I decided that putting out the book would let me, you know, sort of help shape that discussion, particularly in a year where you've got the Biden administration focusing on climate, the European Union, the UK, and the next big meeting after Paris, which got delayed a year, COP26 will be in Glasgow with lots of top leaders there. And, you know, that'll frame, okay, are we driving innovation? What are the near-term goals? And how do we measure how close we are to making it to zero?
Well, and I want to follow up on a number of the points you raise. You talk about the pandemic, and in the book, you write this in terms of framing climate change and the pandemic that we're still in the middle of. You say, quote, by mid-century, climate change could be just as deadly as COVID-19, and by 2100, it could be five times as deadly. Are there, I mean, hearing that is just terrifying and striking, but puts it into focus, I think, for a lot of people. Are there lessons from COVID that we can draw as we fight climate change, particularly when you think about the global community, which you just referenced?
Yeah, so the pandemic definitely fits the idea that governments are supposed to have experts who look ahead to protect its citizens from bad things. You know, we know earthquakes are coming, so we have building codes and we invest in that. We know there might be a war, so we fund the Defense Department and they do war games. In the case of the pandemic, mine was not the only voice warning that the right precautions, for example, to get quick diagnostics available like they did in Australia, that the U.S. and others, including Europe, were not ready. So it's a case where, you know, a small number of billions would have saved many trillions. And so it's tragic that that wasn't done in advance. In the case of the pandemic, it turns out that one tool, a vaccine, which, you know, was created within a year, which is phenomenal. You know, you give another year and lots of distribution and up manufacturing that vaccine, you can largely bring it to an end. I wish climate was that easy. And if you could wait till it happens and it's bad, and then you just in a year invent something and then another year you get it out. Here, because the sources of emissions are so widespread and involve so much physical plant, there's no way you could have that kind of transformation. So it really does make us ask, okay, can government do this when you have to start so much earlier than when the problem becomes acute? And it's more acute near the equator where you have these poor farmers than it is in the United States. Now, the United States has sea level rise, big storms, wildfires. You know, people can visit corals and see that they're all dying. So you have some of the evidence, and I do think that's partly why the younger generation is getting involved in it. It's a much harder problem, but in the book I say it's solvable if we use each of the next 30 years in an aggressive fashion.
Given what you're talking about, the wildfires, the fact that we are seeing some of these weather events more intensely, do we need to start moving toward adaptation measures as we continue to fight climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. The terminology I find a little obscure, but they call the efforts to reduce the emissions mitigation, mm-hmm. and they call the activities to try and minimize the damage that the warming that will definitely take place and has already taken place, they call that adaptation. And the Gates Foundation is very involved in the adaptation because we work with farmers and we want to see them get better seeds that are heat tolerant, drought tolerant, and just more productive. So even if their crop is failing because of bad weather, more like 1 out of 4 years than 1 out of 10, they can have enough in the good years to have a buffer stock and to have savings. And so adaptation, whether it's building seawalls or understanding that these forests are totally drying out. As you get hotter, the interior of the continent, the soils become less and less usable, particularly in the southern part of the U.S. And you see things like feedlots and maize productivity is moving north as you get these successive warming forcings every year. So yes, the evidence is there, but compared to what it'll be by the end of the century, in terms of none of the beaches that you're used to will be around, it's hard to create that awareness. And that's partly why, young people may be the best advocates.
Yeah. And I want to come back to young people. I want to talk, though, first about how you frame this entire problem in your book. You do it with two numbers. You referenced it in that video, 51 billion and zero. You say 51 billion is how many tons of greenhouse gases the world adds to the atmosphere every year, and zero emissions is what we need to achieve. And you write it this way. This was a real aha moment for me. You say, the climate is like a bathtub that's slowly filling up with water. Even if we slow the flow of water to a trickle, the tub will eventually fill up and water will come spilling out onto the floor. That's the disaster we have to prevent. Setting a goal to only reduce our emissions but not eliminate them won't do it. It sounds like a completely daunting task. Why are you still optimistic?
Well, it is a very daunting task. If the goal was to reduce by 30 or 50%, then you could take some of the tougher areas and just say, okay, we won't do those ones. We'll do the easy ones. And even the easy ones aren't, totally easy. So take, for example, moving away from gasoline passenger cars to electric battery gasoline cars, and then making the electric grid zero emission. If you do those two things, then you've taken passenger cars, which are 7% of that 51 billion. And if you replace all the gasoline cars, say you stop selling them in 2035 and their lifetime on the road is under 15 years, then at least you took one piece and you got rid of that 7%. Now you'd still have the rest of those things that you have to do. But that model, shows us that, okay, we can if we tackle everything. Sadly, we've mostly worked on passenger cars and electricity generation. We haven't worked as much on the other ones. The bathtub analogy is helpful because there's a bathtub where the drain is closed because the CO2 stays in the atmosphere for thousands of years. And so you basically can take all the CO2 since the industrial age 200 years ago, and it's fundamentally 95% still there. And that's the thing that causes the heat to get trapped, and so that the average temperature goes up. And until you get to zero, you're just getting hotter and hotter and hotter with all of the ill effects that brings.
You're listening to co-founder of Microsoft, entrepreneur and philanthropist, Bill Gates, whose new book is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. He's joined in conversation by NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Do you have a sense of when the bathtub starts to spill over? I mean, how many years out are we from that?
Yeah, so that's one part of the analogy that's not perfect, because the there is no known tipping point. I mean, for various natural ecosystems, like, you know, that the Arctic ice disappears, you know, the coral reefs die off, all sorts of, you know, bird species and places that used to farm. There isn't a known point at which it just all of a sudden becomes completely disastrous. There is a point where if you live near the equator, you can't grow enough and you have complete instability, civil war, and you try and move north. And you'll have hundreds of millions over the course of the century who will make that decision, bringing, you know, complete instability, which is why the Defense Department list this in their top issues about security going forward. You know, this will make the Syrian civil war look like a tiny thing in terms of the forced migration that will go on there. So if we could do it before 2050, that would be even better. But the 30 years, particularly for the hard categories like steel or cement, and getting all the countries engaged, that is getting the cost of doing things the clean way, which I call the green way, asking not just the U.S., who could afford to do it by perhaps, you know, spending massive amounts of money, but a country like India that's still dealing with basic needs, the basic shelter, you know, electricity for air conditioning because we've made it so hot there, light at night to study. They won't choose, because they're not responsible, to go green unless they're getting subsidies or the price is very, very low. And that's why that new metric, the green premium, is the key thing that will decide by 2050, did you succeed or not? Because India will look at that green premium and say, okay, if it's very high, then they'll do it the non-green way.
Let me read what you write about green premiums in your book. So folks have your definition, then you tell me what I've missed. But you write this: most of these zero carbon solutions are more expensive than their fossil fuel counterparts. In part, that's because the prices of fossil fuels don't reflect the environmental damage they inflict. So they seem cheaper than the alternative. These additional costs are what I call green premiums. So you're talking about additional costs. To follow up with the point that you're just making, how do you convince individuals and countries to pay those costs, particularly the ones that don't have necessarily the resources to do it?
The key is going to be to reduce those costs, and very dramatically. If you take today's emission, the 51 billion tons a year, and you say that would cost $100 a ton to pull those out of the atmosphere, which we can't do yet, but there's a good chance we'll get the cost to that area. Then you'd say the total green premium today is $5 trillion a year. And that's simply way too high that the rich countries will write the checks and send them all these middle-income countries that actually have a much greater population than the rich countries. My feeling is we got it down by 95%. So it's 5.1 $0.1 trillion down, you know, then $250 billion a year, then you could do it. That is, between middle-income countries bearing some of the expense and some subsidization, then it becomes an achievable goal. But that, you know, that's very demanding because you have so many areas that these emissions are coming from. And so it's not just one amazing thing. And it's even once you invent the new thing, getting it, you know, to be used on a global basis, you know, that historically to turn over the steel plants, even when there's a lower cost process, that's, you know, more than 30 years of time before you replace all of that physical infrastructure.
And when you mentioned electric cars, does that fit into the category of green premiums? Should everyone be looking to transfer at some point to an electric car? And I've heard you say in a recent interview, that's actually the low-hanging fruit, that it's the cement and the steel that accounts for 16% of emissions. I believe that's where the real challenge comes in.
Yeah, we can sort all the different emissions by the green premium. I have an example here, which is with the car, you're giving up some range, you know, you worry about the charge points and the charge times, and you're paying more up front. Now, you do save money. The electricity costs less than the gasoline. The maintenance is somewhat less. So today, if we're comparing two Chevrolet products, a Malibu to a Bolt, the green premium's, you know, 10, 15%. Now, the battery companies are innovating. Companies like QuantumScape have a next generation coming. The charge points will be more pervasive. There will be quick charging. And so we can say that as all those things improve, that this green premium will disappear. And that's why a company like General Motors can announce, hey, in 2035, we won't make those gasoline cars anymore because we think customers, even without government incentives, tax credits, the gasoline car will be a superior product. And that's without, you know, a carbon tax or anything about the emissions. And so that means the green premium actually got to zero. The electric car, even without considering emissions, is a preferred product. And, you know, that's nirvana, because then you can take whatever subsidization you have and move it to the other categories, the more difficult categories that aren't nearly as far along. The only ones that are really far along are making electricity with solar and wind, which that has gotten quite cheap, and now the electric car. And so, you know, we have started down this path, and we can follow that pattern that you have to drive the market with special incentives, like the $7,500 credit for the electric car was a key element of bootstrapping that industry, which got, you know, smarter and more competitive. We need to do that for all the other tools for green products as well.
Well, and you talk about the incentives that are already in place for cars. And then I think a lot of people think about the larger forms of transportation, like airplanes. This was also, I think, what was an incredibly enlightening anecdote that you have in your book that I'm going to read. I'm going to do it against the backdrop of, as I was leaving the White House tonight, Reuters reported that airline CEOs are going to be meeting with the White House later this week to talk about cutting the carbon footprint of airplanes. This is what you say about how challenging that is. You say, not long ago, my friend Warren Buffett and I were talking about how the world might decarbonize airplanes. Warren asked, why can't we run a jumbo jet on batteries? He already knew that when a jet takes off, the fuel it's carrying accounts for 20 to 40% of its weight. So when I told him this startling fact that you'd need 35 times more batteries by weight to get the same energy as jet fuel, he understood immediately. The more power you need, the heavier your plane gets. At some point, it's so heavy that it can't get off the ground. Warren smiled, nodded, and just said, ah. It is a very clear anecdote, but it speaks to how challenging it is when you're thinking about airplanes. So what's the takeaway there? And what's the message for these CEOs who are going to be meeting with the White House?
Well, Warren's good at multiplication. when you power a plane, the fuel, the energy density of that fuel is incredible. The fact that, you know, car gasoline or even the special gasoline they use in planes is so cheap is mind-blowing. It's cheaper than bottled water. And, you know, we have this whole industry that makes that available. There's two ways to go with planes. It doesn't look like batteries will ever have enough energy density. So you can make the same fuels we make today, but make them in a way that doesn't involve emissions. So you can use plants and turn them into aviation fuel. I myself, I'm paying a group called World Energy that makes green aviation fuels. And so now I'm buying enough of that it more than offsets all of the travel I do. And then I use other things where I fund direct carbon capture, solar panels, electric cars, to make sure that now I don't have emissions net. But, you know, I had to pay over $400 a ton, which is way unaffordable for everyone to do it that way. And so, you know, again, it's that green premium. The transportation category, the long distance trucks are hard. The planes, as you said, are hard. The ships are hard. So there's another 9%, which is transportation, not including the passenger cars. There are, you know, some wild ideas like using hydrogen, but that's expensive to make and it's fairly hard to store. And Breakthrough Energy just funded a company that's going to try to do it that way. So it's either biofuels or fuels made with electricity called electrofuels, or hydrogen, or the direction we have to go to get aviation down to zero.
You also talk about meat, various farm animals as being emitters as well of methane. So people, of course, have said, well, are you asking us to give up our hamburgers? You've invested in alternative meat. So two-part question for you. Is that what people should start thinking about doing, giving up hamburgers? And what do you say to the farmers who worry, and not just the farmers, anyone in an industry who worries they might be put out of work with these transitions? Do people need to think about moving to areas where there are more green energy jobs? What do you say to those people?
Well, 30 years is a long time. And, you know, the economy is always dynamic, whether or not it's climate or not. You know, whatever product you make, you worry, you know, will there be an alternate better way? These artificial meat companies, Impossible Foods, Beyond Meat, now have their products out in restaurants and grocery stores. And actually, a lot of people are finding them very attractive. You know, they talk about health benefits and, of course, no animal cruelty. So there's a type of competition going on there. The cows, the owners of the cows are trying to change their feed to reduce emissions, to capture it's methane that actually comes out of both ends of the cow. And so, you know, we don't know which approach will make sense. We know that if you become a vegetarian, your carbon footprint goes down. But I don't think it's practical to expect all of the meat eaters in the world to make that change. And so these alternate approaches, of which there are many, are trying to come in and compete. Right now, they have a green premium. That is, you pay a little bit more and they don't taste exactly the same. But as the volume goes up, those companies are going to try and completely fool you so you won't know that it's not ground beef from a cow when you're using their product. And as they scale up the volume, they'll try to get the price down. And so these approaches will compete with each other. You know, in terms of farms, we expect biofuels will be part of the solution. And that actually, and these will be biofuels that actually reduce emissions more than the corn ethanol did. That had some challenges in terms of the emissions benefits. And so all these different sectors, we need them. But yeah, they may have to, you know, grow more biofuels and there may be less cows, but that's the marketplace dynamics will determine that.
Part of what you are focused on is making investments in these companies that are working toward getting to zero emissions. But you say there really needs to be a technological breakthrough. Do you think that's going to happen? Something that we can't even conceive of right now. Realistic?
Well, we're going to have to, in each area of emission, we have to pursue five or six different approaches. The more, the better, because you're absolutely right. These are high-risk companies. You know, the 40 companies in the breakthrough portfolio, sadly, 80% of them will probably not succeed. Now, of that 20%, you know, the categories that they're innovating into are absolutely gigantic categories. And so both as an investor and in terms of the climate impact, you know, the hope is that it's very, very dramatic. But it's very hard to predict how long innovation takes. So it's weird. We have to accelerate it with more R&D and incenting brilliant people to get into this field and lots of risk capital and then a buying signal that even when the green premium is still fairly high, there's at least some demand. So we get going on that. So this is not, it's not going to be easy. We'll need innovations in quite a number of these spaces so that the green premiums are phenomenally reduced.
All right. Well, I could ask you questions all night, but we have some fantastic questions from the audience. I'm going to start with Nick, who asks, what can be done in the next 4 to 8 years to set us on the right track, regardless of who is elected after President Biden? Good question.
Yeah, that it's an excellent question, because when you're talking about the big capital investments in transmission, changing steel factories, these investments will only get made if it's clear that the government favors green activities. And so there's a perception you're going to go, you know, every 4 or 8 years, nobody cares, and then people care. You can't afford that. We've got to use every single one of these years. So I hope that both parties, particularly as the young members are learning more and deciding what their moral connection is to this unbelievable destruction that we'll face, that they accept the goal and then argue about the tactics. I mean, after all, with earthquake prevention or being ready for war, there's plenty you can argue about, but the goal of dealing with the disaster, that's not, you know, some things people say, oh, it's just a hoax. And so we definitely need to see a broadening and a deepening of that commitment. The R&D pieces may be the least controversial because, you know, it's high paying jobs. It's great companies in America. There'll be demand for great products, just like in computers or in health, where the U.S. funding of R&D led to, you know, the U.S. being able to have higher incomes because of the exporting highly valuable products out to other countries. So, you know, it's an opportunity to get there first with American ingenuity.
And just very quickly before I go on to the next question, given that, do we need to codify things like being a member of the Paris Climate Agreement? Obviously, you know, there's been some back and forth there to that question. I mean, in order to make this something that's permanent and not something that vacillates.
Well, in a democracy, you know, the voters can change, you know, so you the key thing the world and the investors will look at is, do both parties believe in a core of activities where avoiding climate disaster counts to them? You know, you have states where the sea level rise, you know, the two most affected states are Louisiana and Florida. And so they're a little less likely to say, hey, strike this word, you know, from every document. So there's, you know, people are, you know, seeing what's going on. But no, if you have one of the major parties that denies the phenomenon or doesn't prioritize it, then the entire world will be let down, because they need the U.S.'s innovation power. It's the majority of the innovation power in the world. We need it to lower the green premiums, not just for ourselves, but for everyone.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is co-founder of Microsoft, entrepreneur and philanthropist Bill Gates, whose new book is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. He's joined in conversation by NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Okay, and this is from Eve. I am a public equity investor. How can we hold companies accountable for their actions? How can we embolden management teams and boards to make changes to their organizations, even if it will negatively impact margins? And then Eve goes on to say, in parentheses, since it is the right thing to do.
Well, I think there's a lot of good work going on in disclosure. And that's helpful because if one company finds a more green approach, then both investors and customers of that company can favor them. Smart potential employees can pick that company over other companies. And, you know, so we need to be seeing what different companies are doing. Now, if you're in the steel industry, just making a product that's super expensive and nobody buying it won't serve your shareholders. So we need the policies so that that company takes their expertise and, you know, is open-minded about collaborating with the universities and national labs what's the easiest way to change these processes to get rid of those emissions. So investing is important. Divesting, you know, sends a signal, but it's really the investment side, particularly on these high-risk companies, or being willing to buy the green products when they're more expensive. That's what's catalytic to actually get the green approach to become mainstream.
Okay. This one is from David, who asks, what energy conservation methods do you advocate? More insulation? What types? Superconducting long-distance electrical transmission systems?
Yeah, so there are approaches that are on the path to zero. And so, for example, innovation in transmission, like superconducting underground wires, would make a huge, huge difference, because then you can drive the electricity network to zero and maintain reliability without building as many of those big towers, where it takes literally decades to get approvals, and you've got to get approvals all the way along the line. So most transmission projects in America, even ones that make immense economic sense, just never get done because of all the ability to say no to that. So the superconducting thing would be huge. Breakthroughs invested in a few companies that are looking at that. There's others. The beauty of it is that you don't get the heat. The reason we transmit power up in the air is we use air cooling for those wires. If you put them underground, the cost of refrigeration, so you don't just keep heating up and melt, is super high. Insulation can be a very good thing to save money. You know, it may just have a direct return, but you can't insulate your way to zero. It won't, you know, you better be heating that building with a zero emission source, which means electricity with a heat pump instead of with natural gas, or, you know, just 10 or 15% reductions in a few rich countries is not on the path to zero. It's a good thing, but not a climate win.
This next one is important because I think it's a question a lot of people have. Hope asks, I believe the Earth is going through a natural climate change. Can we really change that?
Well, every other cyclical thing going on right now in terms of the Earth spin, those things would be cooling the planet. And you can just see from the chart that it's heating up. The only thing that is cooling is actually some of the sulfates from the coal plants used to mask the heating effect of CO2, because the black particulate and the sulfates were somewhat cooling. But now we understand in the models, and we can see the clear trend. So the fact that this is human-generated CO2, there's just no argument about that. You can argue about how quickly the temperature will go up, because there's a multiplier factor that there's still some uncertainty on, and how much that maps into bad weather. You know, how many kids will die in big hurricanes, or how many beaches will disappear, how quickly. The speed of the negative things, there's some uncertainty there. But the fact that it's human-generated CO2, that you can just look at the temperature drop as you go up in the atmosphere, it's called the lapse rate. There's no possible explanation except CO2 greenhouse effect to get exactly the pattern that the actually fairly simple equations predict that. And so, yes, there are many cycles that drive temperature and have in the past, but a spike of CO2 in just a few hundred year period, which, you know, we've gone from the 200 parts per million to 410, that is the what's forcing this warming.
This next one, all of these questions are fantastic. Kathy asks, and I love this one because it was on my list and I didn't ask it. How can just a normal everyday person make an impact on this serious issue? What should we each be doing in our lives every day?
Well, there's a number of ways you can get involved. One is to educate yourself. And it's kind of fascinating, this the science and the economics and the history here. You know, I've certainly enjoyed learning about it. You can talk to other people. You get extra credit if you educate people of both parties to care about the issue. You can make a difference as a buyer in your family. Buying an electric car helps drive that forward. Buying you know, meat that however it's made has a lower green footprint. For all the products you buy now, you'll see various ratings that show how much emissions were associated with making that product. You know, we do need voters to vote. You can't beat your political voice. That, you know, is that particularly for the young generation. Without that, this endeavor won't get the intensity that it absolutely requires. And finally, you know, as an employee or someone who's going to pick a company to work for, we're demanding that all these private sector companies, whether they're in tech or finance, you know, not just the utilities or steel companies, that in their own purchasing, they purchase green products, even if it costs more. And so they're pioneers and actually paying high quality offset money, you know, for the emissions that their travel or products are responsible for.
You talk about the younger generation, just very quickly, if I could follow up with you on that. Our NBC exit polls showed that in 2020, more than 60% of voters thought that climate change was a serious issue. How important is and what is the impact on climate activism, do you think, to this moment and to everything that you're trying to achieve?
We need climate activism, and we need the climate activists to understand, you know, how hard it's going to be. If they think it can be done in 10 years, sadly, you know, then you could even get cynical, because 10 years from now, you're going to see that emissions are at best, you know, globally down, you know, maybe 15% would be doing extremely well. Mm-hmm. And even the U.S., you can't get to zero in 10 years. You just can't replace all the industrial infrastructure that meets basic needs like cement and steel. So the activism is the part that I don't, you know, I'm not somebody who riled up all that interest. And I'm so thankful to the people who do that, and asking them to do a lot more, and not just in some parts of the country, but in all parts of the country. They're the magic ingredient, along with the innovation, that makes me hopeful this can be achieved.
Chad, when you just raised steel again and those really big emitters, says this: there are so many different things that contribute to climate change. How big is the problem really? And if we are going to do the hard stuff first, what should we focus on? Which is a really nice way to frame it.
Yeah, let me put a slide up real quickly that'll show the five areas. I'll be quick on this. The two that people know and we've talked about are electricity and transportation. So that's two of the five. Agriculture, there's some sense we've talked about, cows and fertilizer and manure there. Heating and cooling buildings, we've talked about using electricity instead of natural gas. The biggest of the five categories, which I'm calling manufacturing, 31%, that includes the cement and steel, is the one that I think people have the least awareness of because it's so cheap. You know, they don't take their son to a steel plant. I highly recommend it. You don't have the visibility of the fact that everything around you, its production involves some degree of emissions. And so that is the hardest of the five. And we haven't done enough. In fact, the near-term goals don't focus on those because the lead times on them are very, very long.
And those are categories that have gotten a lot of attention, right? But people keep coming up short because they are so complicated.
Well, yeah, it's hard. You have to innovate, but then, you know, is there a market? You know, the green steel isn't stronger or, you know, it's just a substitute that doesn't happen to involve any emissions. And, you know, it's been tuned and the building codes talk exactly about what the recipe should look like. Our ventures group is looking for anyone with ideas in that area, you know, looking over the entire globe. And we are finding some, but, we behaved almost as though we're just trying to go for a 50% reduction because we should have put more money into the hard stuff over the last decade. But now, you know, we know that we can fix that.
This is from Raputaman, and I hope I have pronounced your name accurately, who asks, given that there is so much resistance to nuclear power in the general public and that it will take a few years before any is built in the U.S., how do you propose we gear up to educate the public and dispel their unfounded fears?
Yeah, that's a great question. Nuclear fission, which I'm one of the people who believe it is likely to be part of the solution, and I fund a company called TerraPower that's building a new generation built from scratch, what they call fourth generation reactor. So over the next 5 years, that demo plant, half funded by the U.S. government and half funded by the private sector, which I guaranteed that half, we'll solve the engineering problems and I believe we'll solve the cost problems. We'll have a good solution for the waste. But even if that all goes extremely well, the public acceptance where, you know, they think about radioactive material in the, particularly Chernobyl, where there was release of, and that caused, actually did kill people, it'll be a lot of work to get the acceptance. It actually, even today's reactors that are complex and not as safe, not inherently safe like the new ones, their track record per unit generated is very, very good. The reason the nuclear even comes up in the discussion is this reliability issue, where if you go to 100% renewables, you can't store, the likelihood of a miracle where you could store enough energy for like 14-day bad weather periods, we're unlikely to have that at any economic price. And so if you could have 20% of the generation that wasn't weather dependent, then you can maintain that reliability so nobody freezes or overheats.
This is the last question, so I'm going to ask you, and then also if you would give us your final thoughts after you answer this question. This is from Jack, the final question. Do you have any advice on communicating the urgency of climate change to people who do not think it is a problem worth addressing?
Yeah, I think, you know, pieces like David Attenborough's video about the Earth where he shows what things look like when he was young, going out into nature, and he shows how that's degrading and, you know, calls on us. He didn't go into, you know, specifics about how we deal with climate change, but calls out that we should care not just for the human damage, which is, you know, the top of the list for me, but also about the beauty of all these natural ecosystems. So there are people like that. The, you know, there was a documentary series, Years of Living Dangerously, all the way back in 2014 that highlighted some of the negative things happening. And all of those are worse today. Sea level rise, you know, inability to grow food near the equator. And so how you take, you know, pieces of that and share them in a non-threatening way, in a way that draws somebody in, we need our best communicators to do that. If you overwhelm them with all the negative things, they'll say, oh, come on, that sounds, you know, A, I don't like it because you're just, it's depressing. And B, okay, you're just throwing the kitchen sink in there, which sadly is the truth. I mean, there's a David Wells Wells book, you know, kind of puts all these things in there and you're like, oh my God, even I feel like it's overwhelming. But, you know, so the, how you strike the right balance of finding out who they would trust and, you know, making sure that's a person who's willing to really dig into the topic and be open-minded and form an opinion. You know, even, you know, drawing in religious leaders, drawing in, you know, people from the industries that are affected so that they, you know, they see that the change is necessary. You know, I'm hopeful my book, you know, helps the dialogue about what the plan looks like, but creating that activism, you know, I only feel like, well, what else would young people stand for? And are you really going to be a bystander while this thing is happening? You know, I really hope not.
Well, what an incredible conversation. Bill Gates, thank you so much. And again, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. You talk about the importance of communicating. I do think a lot of people sometimes feel intimidated by thinking about climate change, and you make it very accessible and understandable. So thank you so much for being here tonight, for sharing all of your thoughts and knowledge with us on this really critical topic. And again, thank you, Bill Gates. What a great conversation.
Thank you. It was great.
You have a great night, everyone.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was co-founder of Microsoft, entrepreneur and philanthropist Bill Gates, whose new book is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, The Solutions We Have and the Breakthroughs We Need. He was joined in conversation by NBC News correspondent Kristen Welker. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamitwan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.